Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me on.
So could you tell us a bit about this so-called secret message?
Well, indeed. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that it's not such a secret message in the sense that it was first seen in 1904, so, you know, 10 years or so after the painting. And remember, the painting that you're referring to, the 1893 version, is one of, you know, I think at least five versions, if you include the very first one, the little pastel that precedes it, and then, of course, the lithographs and the pastel that came after it that was sold for $120 million odd a few years back in 1895, and then a later one. But they all share some characteristics. And the 1893 one, with this little scribble about it must have been, it could only have been made by a madman. We always thought that that might have been a critic or some scrawl relating to the showing of the very sort of hostile reception of this painting, this 1893 painting, when it was shown in 1895. But it now seems that because the wonderful conservators and curators in Norway have been thinking and working on this painting for a while, that they think that this matches closely Munch's own handwriting, that he was actually associating himself and his own state of derangement or madness with this painting. It might be ironic, of course, and if you think about that sort of irony, Munch was part of a sort of bohemian set in the 1890s in Christiania, which is now Oslo, which that set were kind of proud of their decadence in some ways, that they weren't healthy and upstanding citizens, that they were a little bit decadent and a little bit. In a way, you might think it might be him referring to, you know, he must be mad as a kind of almost a badge of honor. But we also must remember that Munch himself came from a family riddled by problems, both, you know, the tuberculosis that killed one of his sisters and his mother, the mental problems that ruined the life of another of his sisters, and the early death of his brother, that Munch was beset with, many tragic and complicated circumstances. So that the scream, you know, you might say, well, it's ironic, but in fact, it does refer to Munch's particular take on turbulence and expressing some of that psychological turbulence, which is why it's so iconic and has become so sort of recognizable today as not just a personal picture or sort of autobiographical picture, but one that expresses a wider psychological anxiety.
Yeah. And before we discovered that the handwriting matched Munch's, you know, was there any guess as to who else might have been involved with it? Were there other characters in this narrative that was crafted around the picture?
Yeah, so there were a bunch of critics. So, as I say, in 1895, a show of Munch's work, which was going to be part of this marvelous sort of epic project called The Frieze of Life, was shown some of the pictures were shown in an exhibition in 1895, and they did not go down very well. So there were critics, a medical student, Schaffenberg, and others, who decided that, you know, Munch must be part of a kind of a degenerate tendency. And remember that that's a word that, while used in the 1890s to sort of worry about whether the health of this nation, Norway, this slightly young nation, if you like, if you think about it as only having separated from sort of Swedishness a while, but, you know, that people were falling into degeneracy and a lack of physical fitness. But we also know that word comes later in the 20th century to be very much associated with attacks by right-leaning camps against, you know, artists who are regarded as mad. Mm. But so, in a sense, we thought that it might be that critical reaction that, you know, this is a mad artist, this is an artist who just doesn't make sense. And you know, there was a lot in the air where an artist like Munch was really, although we now regard him as, you know, a visionary and extraordinary, that that very strangeness that the painting still has, you must imagine yourself in 1895 trying to sort of read it and think, well, you know, why is this skull-like thing like a mummy? And in fact, it's been often compared to him. He might have seen a Peruvian mummy in a show. You know, why isn't it properly naturalistic and articulated?
Yeah.
What's going on here? So you can imagine, you've got to put yourself in the position of a museum goer in 1895 or an exhibition goer who might be confronted by this.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me is we've spoken before here on Tuesday Drive about Vanitas and the way that it used hyper-realism to kind of, I guess, critique the same things that it's sounding like were emergent in the culture of Norway at the time there.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting because obviously the skull-like nature of the head in might remind some people of kind of, you know, skeletal figures from Vanitas imagery and the sort of ever-possessiveness of death. But in fact, this is a highly animated painting. And remember that Munch himself had the scream that of the title is not actually the scream of a person, but the scream of the landscape. The sort of the scream of the clouds as actual blood, the color shrieked, and you know he's talking about a landscape. So it's the way that the figure's head and the landscape swirling out those deep reds and the strangenesses of the contrast of colors. That's all. It's not just that a person might be crying out, but almost like the whole of the picture plane is sort of distorted and overexcited and complicated. And that, in a way, is sort of, you know, at the heart of the it's both a very profound and very disturbing painting. And so, you know, and when the guy, the owner of the 1895 version, the industrialist who sold it at auction in 2012, he made a really moving statement when he sold the painting that in fact what he saw in it when he saw it was the scream of the landscape that humans are killing. So it had an environmental interpretation. So, you know, it's a painting that, you know, from the psychological to the sort of expressionist in the 1910s and 20s who wanted to figure sort of the human dilemmas all and then now to an environmental interpretation, it sort of keeps on giving this painting in some way.
Definitely. And I mean, there's entire stories about, I believe it was stolen in 1994 and returned some years later.
Yeah, well in fact, it's amazing. The stories are brilliant because the 1893 version was stolen in the 90s and there was a famous sting by the British and Norwegian police that brought it back. And then, of course, they bungled that sting a bit so that they couldn't, the person that was involved in it had to be released. But then the later version, the 1910 version, was also stolen. And that was the one stolen in the 2000s, and they had recovered it through, again, slightly murky means, but it came back. And obviously, you know, part of that is a story about, you know, stolen art, which is always a great story. But it's also because these are iconic. These are sort of, this someone has called it, you know, modernism's Mona Lisa. It's the kind of painting that sort of resonates and has a value beyond the art world. People recognize it, you know, the fact that it's been emojied now and you can have a sort of scream emoji, screaming in fear. You know, it's really sort of memed its way into our consciousness, this painting. And,
definitely.
And it sort of keeps a resonance, you know.
All righty. Well, Mark, it has been so good speaking with you here on Tuesday Drive, and thank you so much for joining us to talk about The Scream. As you say, it's really spiked its own relevancy back again, and it's always great to hear about it. So thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, not at all. Been a pleasure.